us here. We know our exposure, and I guess that summarizes the motivation, which is today leading an increasing number of leadership people active in their lives and in leadership roles to try to move the is of near destruction to what ought to be. So for me, at least, that should be the motivation of our people and the country and of reasonable people here and there. Thank you.
I want to thank Ambassador Solomon and the Institute for Peace and Ambassador Goodby for inviting me. This is kind of the mundane following the sublime, so bear with me. And I also want to say that a lot of what we're talking about is kind of anticipated in this report that Ambassador Solomon mentioned that we did at Carnegie. I was not the author of the report. I was one of the authors, Joe Cerencioni and others, Universal Compliance, and a lot of what we're talking about in this kind of sense of a restored bargain and the idea of kind of moving towards a more equitable nuclear order was anticipated there. I want to start by playing off something Ambassador Kampelman said when he talked about the ought. And he also acknowledged that many people say it's not practical. And in philosophy, there's a saying, you know, ought does not imply can. But I think there needs to be a corollary that he also pointed to, which is that difficult does not mean impossible. And I think that's part of the inspiration of those now working on this challenge. And there are a couple of things that I think need to be gotten out of the way of early on as kind of red herrings or canards that are put out to stop further thinking about this. One of them, and I saw this in a news clip yesterday, General Chilton, the new commander of Strategic Command, very impressive, sharp guy, was testifying in Congress, and evidently somebody asked him about this, and he said that he'd like to have a world where his two daughters, I believe he said, would live free from nuclear threats, but that he didn't think that unilateral disarmament was a wise course or would make us safer. And I read that and I thought, who's proposing unilateral nuclear disarmament? All of the discussions, Ambassador Kampelman, everything that we're talking about, the premise of most serious work on this issue, is precisely not that it be unilateral disarmament, but rather a negotiated, universal, reciprocal, verifiable project of dismantling nuclear weapons, which is why it's so difficult, or why it would be so difficult. But there's something in the way that people hear this idea where it gets almost automatically interpreted that what one's advocating is unilateral disarmament, because I run into that all of the time. And so I think there needs to be a kind of a constant effort or refrain to remind people at the very beginning that's obviously not a good idea. That wouldn't leave us more secure. What's being talked about is a framework for making the world safe for the dismantlement of nuclear arsenals in a way where there would be enforcement and verification, which again is why it's so hard. Similarly, and kind of the same answer is, people often say, well, nuclear weapons can't be disinvented, can't be uninvented. And the response to that is, obviously that's true, but you can't disinvent or uninvent a lot of things that civilization has decided it doesn't want to live with, that it wants to ban. We didn't disinvent, no one disinvented large-scale gas chambers. But the world decided that it wasn't a good idea to have those around. Action was taken, and somebody could still reinvent something like that, but there's a sense that that's beyond the pale. CFCs that were used to refrigerate us in houses, refrigerators, air conditioners, and so on, it was realized they were putting a hole in the ozone layer. People say, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Everybody has CFCs. They're in every house in the developed world in any case. But there was a decision, well, we couldn't afford not to do it, and so they were banned. And I can't tell you right now where on earth, but I imagine there's some place where someone's cheating on that ban. And maybe it's catastrophic. It probably isn't. But there's a decision to do something. You put in implementation. You try to verify it, and you move forward. Obviously, with nuclear weapons, the stakes would be much higher. Again, that's why it would be very difficult. But it's not a matter of disinvention. It's a matter of saying, we want to dismantle these things. We don't want them to be legitimate at some point in time. And then we need to establish ways to verify that and to enforce if there is cheating. If that can't be done, if confidence can't be obtained in the verification, but more importantly, the enforcement, because even if verification could be 100% reliable, which it never will be, you would still have to have a strong enforcement capability because somebody could break out. So the stakes really focus on enforcement. And if the confidence won't be built in enforcement capabilities, there won't be nuclear disarmament. So it's a fairly straightforward proposition, and that's where a lot of the work needs to be done. Now, I was asked, or kind of the Oslo conference last week is kind of the precipitating event for this discussion, and so I want to talk a little bit about what I found most interesting there. And that is that the Norwegian government and the Seven Nation Initiative of which it's part did a very good service by having a representation from a lot of the leading non-nuclear weapon states and developing countries. So there was a much kind of greater north-south composition to the discussion than one often has when talking about nuclear weapons. And what that enabled, or what that brought forward, was the reality that in many ways we're, without really knowing it, trying to renegotiate the nuclear order. That there was a nuclear order that was built on the Cold War, mainly by the U.S. and the Soviet Union in that standoff, and that created the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which, remember, was a joint U.S.-Soviet text. It was something, notwithstanding the Cold War, that both superpowers absolutely knew they wanted, which was no one else to get nuclear weapons, and so they really cooperated and enforced that. But when the Cold War ended, it was kind of natural that the basis of that order started to erode, perhaps. And I think we're at a point where, if it were a stock, you know, the broker's saying basically either sell or hold. But there are not a lot of buy orders going in for the existing nuclear order. That's a stock that's going to really pay off in the future. And so people are kind of recognizing and trying to figure, okay, we need to innovate, to renovate, to have a new order, a spinoff, something of that type. And I think that's a big part of the motivation of the work of Secretary Nunn and Schultz and Max Kampelman and Ambassador Goodby and others, is this sense that proliferation is not going to be prevented. We're not going to be able to prevent it. We're not going to be able to rally the world to enforce the rules that we need to manage nuclear technology if there's not, in essence, a new bargain. That with the possible renaissance of nuclear power, that's one of the reasons we need a new or renovated nuclear order. And the insight is that you're not going to get agreement globally on the rules that we need to manage kind of this new order and nuclear technology, if the weapon states aren't prepared to say we're willing to create an equitable order where no one has nuclear weapons, and so everybody would have a kind of a common basis for investing in this way of managing nuclear technology. I think that's the basic insight. Now, at the conference, what happened, and I think this was it was very useful to hear, is you got a sense of the disjuncture, the gap between folks primarily from the U.S. but also the United Kingdom, which is kind of out in front on this issue of nuclear disarmament, and developing countries, the non-nuclear weapon states. In other words, there's a certain sense about if the nuclear weapon states do a few things, then we'll get these new rules, for example, to preclude the distribution of uranium enrichment capability in countries that don't have them. Or that the additional protocol, the stronger inspection system that that the IAEA seeks, that a lot of people advocate, but which hasn't been adopted in key countries, that could become mandatory if the weapon states offer more on disarmament. But what became clear is weapon states, and again, primarily Americans and the Brits, because Russians aren't really out talking about this, the Chinese aren't talking about it at all. I have French friends here. You know, France is out in the forefront of wanting to talk about this agenda. They've done a lot of good things, but it's not an issue where France is out in front. It's the United Kingdom as a government, and then distinguished Americans are pushing this. But we're talking amongst ourselves for the most part, and so there hasn't been a real discussion with South Africa, Brazil, Mexico, Sweden, Norway, other countries that are leaders of the non-nuclear weapon states, about what would it take? What do the bargains look like? So, for example, is there any circumstance under which non-nuclear weapon states would agree now to preclude acquiring uranium enrichment capability as a global rule? There's kind of an expectation that that's what the objective should be, but are there any takers? It seemed evident at the conference from the discussion of some that there's no way. And then if you talk to, for example, Brazilian officials or South African officials, they say there is no way we're going to agree not to acquire uranium enrichment capability as a matter of principle, but in these cases as a matter of practice. They want to actually start, and Brazil already has started an enrichment industry. Egyptian representatives said, no way as a matter of principle. We might not do it. We're not saying we need to enrich. We might not, but we'll never give up the right. And in all of this, by the way, people are taking their cue from Iran, because Iran has defended that, A, there's a right to uranium enrichment, which I don't think is a proper reading of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but it's become a customary reading. So they insist on it. They're under under UN Security Council sanctions to stop, and they're saying no, and they're getting away with it. And so everybody else looks at that and they say, well, if they're not giving up this right, and they're the bad guys, and they're under sanction, why should we, the good guys, give up this right? Well, that kind of emerged more clearly at Oslo than I think you know, kind of people might expect, and it has lots of implications. Similarly, the additional protocol is something that self-evidently you can't get close to a world without nuclear weapons without much stronger inspections, you know, additional protocol plus. But right now we can't get a whole lot of countries that are key. Somewhere among the states that haven't implemented the additional protocol: Egypt, Indonesia, Syria, Serbia, Brazil, Argentina. These are key countries going forward. They're not agreeing to the additional protocol now. So the question is, what would it take for them and for everybody to accept the additional protocol? That negotiation hasn't happened. That bit of bargaining hasn't happened. And the answer, it also wasn't clear. It wasn't clear that those countries themselves know what it would take. And so, for example, one puts forward and says, well, what about the CTBT? If the United States ratifies the CTBT, and then China ratifies the CTBT, and Egypt and other countries that haven't done the CTBT, would that do it? Well, a reaction from some of these countries, and it's mainly directed at the U.S., so it's kind of ignoring that China hasn't ratified and Egypt hasn't, and so on, but it's focused mainly at the U.S., and they say, that one has to be free, because you sold that to us twice, and you never delivered it. And now you're coming back and saying you want me to pay for it again, and I'm going, but wait a minute, you didn't show up when you promised it in 1968 when we negotiated the NPT. And then in 1995, when you persuaded us all to indefinitely extend the Non-Proliferation Treaty, you promised it again. And you tried. I mean, you signed it. But then your Senate wouldn't ratify it. And so now you're coming back to us and saying, okay, we need you to give us some more for the CTBT. And I say, no, that's it. We already did it. That one's free. Then we can talk. Which obviously isn't going to be the view in the U.S. Senate, I would reckon. So that if people want to put the CTBT back to the Senate, which is in many ways a sine qua non of kind of the bargain that's being demanded, I don't expect that you're going to get 67 senators saying, yeah, let's just do it and don't expect more on nonproliferation as kind of a quid pro quo. So that kind of emerged a bit. There are other similar things that happen when you have this discussion. And one of the things that we forget is that for reasons of accident, for reasons of personality, for reasons of Iran, the NPT process has kind of broken down. That's where you're supposed to have these discussions kind of with everybody, the non-nuclear weapon states and nuclear weapon states, about kind of the bargain and how these trade-offs go. But for the last number of years, it's broken down, and one can, I don't need to specify, kind of why and under what conditions and so on. There's plenty of blame to go around. But as a consequence, what's been lost is the sense of, are we in the context of a bargain anymore? What is it? What are the prices for what we want? And the weapon states want more now to manage nuclear technology, but it's not clear what the price would have to be. Those things kind of emerged up in various ways. You had to listen carefully to get it sometimes because people were being polite and subtle, but also there were times to talk in the hallways, and so it was kind of clear that there was people were very excited by this vision and by the opportunity, but there's a lot to kind of be worked out if everybody's expectations are going to be met. And so it was then very impressive for me when Secretary Shultz got up to close the conference after the 2 days. And I'd never met him until last August, and I he's one of the most impressive individuals I've ever met. I mean, truly formidable. And so I was curious because he had been sitting there for 2 days listening to all, in the front row, listening to all this. And so I was kind of curious how he was going to respond because there were a lot of difficulties, And he got up and he said, I've been listening. I've been listening to all this very attentively, and I've learned a lot. And I've gotten a sense of just how tough the details are going to be, and how difficult this is, and how much has to be worked out. He says, but I have to tell you something. He said, if the highest leaders in the world, starting with the President of the United States, were committed and communicated their commitment to figure out how to get rid of these weapons, he said, this discussion would have been entirely different. And the details would be different, and the dynamic about the details would be different. And I have a feeling he's right, because the room kind of got quiet and a lot of people nodded, and you started reimagining the discussion, and it looks very different if that is the vision. And I think that's the insight of what Ambassador Kampelman was talking about, and kind of the insight behind this project. And it's the basic idea that it's no longer possible to have a stable and secure nuclear order in the world if it's not based on equity. If it's based on discrimination, some people have nuclear weapons and you're trying to get other people not to, it's inherently unstable. And you might have been able to get away with that kind of thing in a balance of power situation like we had during the Cold War. But in the situation that we have today, and under globalization and with higher expectations and post-colonial movement and the end of apartheid and all these kind of things, if it's not based on equity, it's not going to be stable. And I think that's the way to go forward. One last recommendation, which was made by the foreign minister of Norway at the end of the conference. And by the way, we'll post on the Carnegie website today, I'm hoping, the foreign minister's recommendations and closing speech. There is a website from the conference, but they seem to be slow in putting up stuff. So we'll have it on our website. But one of the recommendations, which I think is worth considering, is that the international community needs to start wrestling with these issues in a much more explicit way, these difficult issues about verification, about enforcement, and so on. And so the idea would be to take a cue from the climate change issue, where you had the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change created in 1988 of experts, not a negotiation, but experts from around the world, to look at the science, to look at the threats, to start developing the models, to examine policy proposal and alternatives and kind of measure what their implications would be, and then to feed that information into governments so that governments, when they wanted to move on this, had a basis. And so the idea would be, on the issue of eliminating nuclear weapons, a similar kind of intergovernmental panel of experts, whether they be officials, former officials, or other experts, to start looking at verification issues that arise, to look at the issues of managing nuclear fuel cycle, future nuclear technology, to look at enforcement questions. Is it going to have to be the UN Security Council? What role could the IAEA play? What capabilities does it have? There are a range of other issues. How do ballistic missile defenses fit into this possibility or not fit into this possibility? And right now there is no such forum there. The call for something like this is actually explicit in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but it's never been done. And it's also one of the 13 steps that were agreed in the 2000 NPT review conference. So if the weapon states and others were to propose this over the next couple of years, I think it would be an opportunity for them to say, okay, we're taking our obligations seriously, we're manifesting commitments we've already made by getting this going, not a negotiation, again, but an exploration. And I think that would be useful. It's consistent with what's been discussed here. And so I'll leave you with that idea and turn it over to Ambassador Goodby. Thanks.
Well, I think that George captured the spirit of the talks in Oslo pretty well in his remarks. I'd like to talk with you about an area that I didn't think was covered very much in the discussions. I think probably it was natural it was not. And that is the question of how you actually get to zero. How do you achieve a world without nuclear weapons? What do the nuclear weapon states have to do to get there? And I want to talk about that because although I fully agree with the idea that you have to have the vision in order to make the actions more possible, realizable, I think unless you have a vision that is rooted in some sense of reality, plausibility, credibility, the whole idea begins to unravel and collapse ultimately. I think I'll begin with a story that Sam Nunn told at lunch in Oslo on the second day to illustrate the changes that I think have occurred in the world in the past 20, 30 years as a way of getting into the subject. He said when he first went to the U.S. Senate from the state of Georgia, he was receiving a lot of mail from people that he sort of thought of as nutcases. There were people talking about space aliens and things of that type. And it took quite a bit of time to respond to these people, and he wasn't quite sure whether he should waste his time or bother doing it. So he went to his fellow Georgia senator, Senator Herman Talmadge, on the floor of the Senate one day, and said Talmadge always had a brass platoon under his desk and used it fairly often. And he said to Senator Talmadge, "Tell me, I've been receiving a lot of mail from some of these nutcases, and it takes a lot of time to answer, but do you think I should bother doing that?" And he said, Helmage looked at him, he said, "Answer him." He said, "If you don't carry the nut vote, you won't carry a single county in Georgia." So I offer that to tell you that there is now a difference between the nuclear abolitionists of 20 or 30 years ago. The perception, I think, of nuclear abolitionists, it looks like this. I don't know whether you can see it, but the wild-eyed, long-haired guy out there in the streets yelling and shouting and so forth. Now the nuclear abolitionist is, guess what? Men in dark suits, women in dark suits, people like George Shultz. But not only the four people who signed these two op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, but previous secretaries of state from every administration, including James Baker, including Madeleine Albright, including Colin Powell from the current Bush administration. Each of the Secretaries of State supported the general idea that we should move towards a world without nuclear weapons. And why? I think all of them have become convinced that indeed the world has changed. The idea of nuclear deterrence in this era does not carry the same weight and the same argument that it did 20 or 30 years ago. As Senator Nunn often says, now we are concerned about threats that have no return address. So what do you do in that era, in that kind of a situation? The idea, I think, I should read out to you because it basically is the key to their thinking. Without the bold vision, this comes from the first of the two op-eds, but the thought is echoed in the second one as well. Without the bold vision, the actions will not be perceived as fair or urgent. Without the actions, the vision will not be perceived as realistic or possible. So the question I think we need to address, and a lot of study and a lot of effort by all of you people interested in this subject is going to be necessary, is it credible? Well, I personally think it is, and I think if you look at the three, what I regard as the three key papers presented at last October's a meeting at the Hoover Institution, sponsored by the Nuclear Threat Initiative and Hoover. And by the way, you can find these on the Hoover website. There's a book called The Reykjavik Revisited, and it has in it summaries of each of these papers. The three I regard as key is one by David Holloway on reductions of strategic nuclear warheads, one by Bruce Blair on the subject of extending warning time, extending decision time, otherwise known as de-alerting, and one by Rose Gardemuller on eliminating tactical nuclear weapons, beginning with those that are in Europe, U.S., NATO, basically. These papers essentially point towards a U.S.-Russian agenda. And one of the main impressions I took away with me from Oslo is that there is massive support everywhere for that kind of renewal of negotiations between the United States and Russia in many, many areas. I would also say another area of agreement, I think, that I seemed that I perceived in Oslo was they all felt that this no longer could be confined to a kind of strategic negotiation between the two, quote, superpowers as they used to be, or as Russia used to be. It has to be global this time. It has to include all of the nuclear weapon states and the near nuclear weapon states and the non-nuclear weapon states. They all have to be involved in some way. And I think there was also general support for the idea that there is a linkage between nuclear reductions and what the non-nuclear weapon states are being asked to do, although that is challenged quite a bit in the literature you read these days. The paper that Holloway did, I'll just briefly tell you the outlines of it. It basically said, let's try to focus on operationally deployed nuclear warheads, which is what the Treaty of Moscow does, as you know. The 1,700 and 2,200 warheads refers to operationally deployed nuclear warheads, not to all warheads. Does not apply at all to non-deployed reserve warheads. So what you could do, it basically is amend that treaty to say instead of 1,700, 1,000 by a certain year. You would need to extend the verification provisions of the START treaty. Those discussions have been underway for some time. I'm not privy to how far along they are, but clearly you do need to have some kind of verification in order to deal with continuing reductions. And a lot of the verification provisions in the START treaty, I think, were adequate to do that. We know how to do operationally deployed nuclear warheads a lot better than we know how to do the non-deployed. So Holloway's paper basically said, let's go down to 1,000. Then the second stage, he talks about going down to 500 operationally deployed warheads. This is between the United States and Russia, with 500 non-deployed as a ceiling. Finally, in stage three, you go down to zero operationally deployed, plus 500 in reserve, not deployed, non-deployed. And then there's a fourth stage down to zero, and he freely admits it's going to be difficult to get to that last point. I mention these, it's just a schedule, but it basically raises a lot of questions that we need to think more about. How do you prevent breakout? How do you deal with reconstitution? How do you deal with latent nuclear weapon states and so forth? These are areas that have been talked about and discussed from time to time, but they've not received the same kind of serious studies either in the government or in academia or in think tanks that I think they now deserve if we're going to make this idea of eliminating nuclear weapons a credible kind of option. The de-alerting paper by Bruce Blair, I think many of you probably know about his thoughts, but basically the idea is to try to prevent rapid launch of nuclear missiles either by procedural methods or by some physical device being interposed to prevent their being launched quickly. Again, as Sam Nunn often says, it's not a good idea that the president of Russia gets only 5 minutes to decide whether he should launch a return attack if some signal comes in saying an attack is underway. So that's an important stage. Some of that could be done unilaterally, by the way, but most of it really ought to be done between the United States and Russia. And there are quite a bit of things that illuminating that problem in the paper that Bruce Blair did. Tactical nuclear weapons, Rose Gottemuller's paper essentially says that this is going to be tough because it involves, first of all, consultations with NATO allies, because the U.S. nuclear weapons, tactical weapons that are deployed in Europe, are there as a consequence of NATO agreements. You have to negotiate that. And it's going to be difficult from the standpoint of Russia as well, because tactical nuclear weapons in Russia are seen as a kind of a counterpoise to conventional capabilities held by others, including China. The idea, I think, that Gottemuller has, shared by Holloway, by the way, is that what you would try to do is consolidate these tactical nuclear weapons that are deployed in various places around Russia, as well as in Western Europe, into central areas of storage and have some kind of transparency. Ultimately, of course, you would have tactical nuclear weapons merged with strategic nuclear weapons as you go down to lower levels, and probably the 500 or the zero that are mentioned in terms of operationally deployed at some point would have to include the tactical as well as the strategic. So those are the three areas that I regard as needing further study, but also fairly well developed in terms of the concepts, at least. And you can find that in the Hoover website under the title of a book called Reykjavik Revisited. These things were not much discussed in Oslo, and I think probably because a lot of people didn't want to talk about them, and probably because these do really have to be discussed, in my view, between the United States and Russia first. So the question is Russia ready to do this? As I came in, I had a brief discussion, I think, with Bob Berry, who said that he'd heard that the window was not open for negotiations between the United States and Russia. We hear different things. We had a General Dvorkin at Hoover Institution last October. He presented some papers, which I have with me, in which he clearly said, let's go towards zero. And he clearly talked about the idea of de-alerting. And we've heard those ideas since then, including as recently as in Oslo. So the view that I can tell you is held by Henry Kissinger and by George Shultz is that the door is open. That's the phrase they use, the door is open. They get this, I think, not only from conversations that I've overheard, but also from discussions that have taken place within a group chaired on the Russian side by former Prime Minister Primakov, and on the U.S. side by the former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, in which Nunn and Shultz are both involved. These take place a couple of times a year and are quite private, but they sense in those talks that the door is open. That's the phrase that Shultz likes to use. So I think that what I would recommend, frankly, is that pretty soon, and I would even say maybe even in this administration, President Medvedev and President Bush, if he wants to do this, should issue a statement saying they are both committed to the idea of a world without nuclear weapons. And if they were to do that, if not this year, then next year, a different president, I think that would be the first step. After that, a lot of things would have to be done bilaterally with the Russians. The Indians, the Chinese, and the British had comments to make on these general ideas in Oslo and on other occasions as well. My perception is that the Indians feel that they have now a system where their nuclear weapons are not within a military planning sphere, that they are held in the political side, that they are not weapons that would be used in anybody's war plans. They seem ready to talk about how they would like to stay in that particular configuration. And I think if we do have a situation where the United States and Russia begin to negotiate and to reduce, as Holloway's paper suggests, you would have to ask something about from India and Pakistan, China, and so forth. And the three things I think you would ask that Holloway also mentions, of course, is you would not want to have any build-up by those countries. You would not want to have these countries go into an operationally deployed status. They're not in operationally deployed status now. And you'd want greater transparency than now exists, those three things. And that, I think, would go quite a long way towards containing a threat that could be developing over the next years. But a lot of it depends on the United States and Russia beginning the process, because that's the way India, China, all these other countries see it. 95%, after all, the nuclear weapons of the world are held by the United States and Russia, so it's natural these countries would say, okay, you start doing something first. China takes pretty much the same position. Their forces are not operationally deployed, strategic forces, and they've always said and still say, yes, they're interested in seeing reductions, and no, they have no objection in principle, the idea of a world without nuclear weapons, and I'd like to get into that subject. I think the British and the French at some point will have some operational problems with going to zero operationally deployed nuclear warheads because of their numbers of warheads being very small, in the case of the British feeling the need of continuously at-sea deterrence. But the British leadership has definitely said, and it's on the record, is saying they would like to see a world without nuclear weapons. They started some serious verification studies, mainly with the Norwegians, and they've been cooperating with our weapons laboratories as well in talking about these subjects. So I think they're committed. I think both they and the French are going to have some practical problems, but these are the kinds of things that we can solve, I think, as we go along. So I'll end there so we can have some discussion. Thank you very much.
We have about 45 minutes left, and as you said, our technique here is if you'll queue up at the two microphones, that way everyone will be able to hear you and your question will be captured on our video, and we'll alternate the two microphones, and if you could begin by identifying yourself, your institutional affiliation, and indicate who you'd like to direct a question to, we'll proceed.
Thank you. Jonathan Tucker, James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. It's often said that terrorists don't sign treaties, so I just wondered how these initiatives would address the threat of nuclear terrorism.
You want to take a bunch, or you want to do one at a time?
Why don't you start off one at a time?
I don't know what the others think. I'm writing about this a little now. I'd work back from several directions. One is there's the prevention issue, which everyone or most people who work on this field know fairly straightforwardly. It's the issue of the fissile material. We basically know where it is. It's a question of kind of the political will and the focus to get it secured and centralized. So there's the agenda on the prevention side. On the side of kind of deterrence or retaliation or consequence management, I haven't found, I mean, the question would be, what role does nuclear weapons have to deal with that problem? So it's not that nuclear terrorism isn't a potential problem issue, but it's not clear at all how nuclear weapons are the solution to that problem. And so and there are various ways you can parse through this, but there's one argument, well, these people aren't deterrable. I don't know that that's true, but if it were true, then kind of your nuclear deterrent's not clear what the role there is. People say, well, yeah, that's right, except there might be states that would supply these terrorists, and so we need to threaten with our nuclear weapons those states if they supply the terrorists. Maybe, but then that starts getting tricky because at the same time you're trying to get all these states to give us access to nuclear material to fingerprint their nuclear material so we could attribute, if a terrorist did do it, where it came from. So simultaneously be going to people and say, give us the information we need for our fingerprint file from you so that if your stuff ever gets out, we can nuke you in retaliation for having gotten it out. And so that part doesn't make may not make so much sense. Well, then another argument is, yeah, but if a state's harboring terrorists, then we should, you know, we need nuclear weapons maybe to threaten them to make them stop harboring terrorists. Okay, again, maybe, but we already have this problem with Pakistan. We have this problem. They're terrorists in Germany. I mean, they're terrorists in lots of places. So nobody's saying, well, we should threaten Germany with nuclear retaliation because there may be some terrorists there. So what this really means is there are a few Muslim countries where there may be terrorists that we should threaten. So then you're getting into the dynamic of, does it help those governments get rid of their terrorists if there's a public perception that the United States may be threatening them with nuclear attack if they don't? My argument would be it probably doesn't help that much and is not necessary because there are other ways to do that. So for me, when you go through, then the last thing is, well, the argument might be terrorists in bunkers. And so then you need nuclear weapons. But again, the problem is to get the bunker, you have to find the bunker. And our main problem has been intelligence to be able to know exactly where such things are. And if your intelligence were that reliable that the president would authorize the use of a nuclear weapon to go after a bunker, you could make an argument there's probably some other way to get to that bunker than a nuclear weapon. And if the intelligence isn't reliable enough where the president would do that, then nuclear weapons can't solve the problem because you don't know where you're aiming them. So when I kind of look through this and say, is nuclear terrorism an argument against moving towards eliminating nuclear weapons, doesn't seem at all that that's the case, though nuclear terrorism's a problem.
Just a couple of points on prevention. Prevention, point number one, is that the more nuclear weapon states that acquire nuclear weapons, the greater the danger is that these weapons will somehow find their way into the hands of terrorists. So you want to have a successful proliferation effort. And second, one of the papers, of course, in the Hoover Report is by Matt Bunn about all the proliferation, anti-proliferation things that we all know about. And the reason I mention that is that the relative unwillingness of some of the non-nuclear weapon states to sign on to some of these agreements, one would hope would be changed by a more positive attitude towards abolishing nuclear weapons. For example, in the case of UN Security Council Resolution 1540, potentially a very powerful instrument, but it is not, hasn't been subscribed to by a lot of countries that don't submit reports. And so the idea of emphasizing a new contract, if you will, is important just in the case of that sort of issue.
Stephen Young, with the Union of Concerned Scientists. First, I want to thank USIP and Carnegie and BASIC for having this event, because it's obviously clearly a vital issue, and I think we're nearing what we hope is a tipping point on this issue. Actually, I have a fairly modest question for George on your comments on the TTBT and the Senate, and your thought that perhaps the Senate might want something else before they would be ratified the treaty. Just want to see what you're asking, what you're basing that on. I mean, the debate about it in 99 was on verification and sustainability, not about the rest of the world at all. It was about what can we do? Can we trust anybody else? It wasn't about anybody else doing anything. Is your concern speculation, or do you have people saying that? What's your thought on that?
It's speculation and interaction with some folks in the DOE community who may not be so wild about CTBT. And the dynamic, why I think that in order to bring it back to the Senate, there's going to have to be an argument of why we need to do this. And it would seem to me that any president would at least make part of that argument. We really care about nonproliferation because that's something that is bipartisan people really care about. And so in order to advance our national interests on nonproliferation, we need to do this thing on CTBT, because otherwise why do it? And so then somebody intelligent as Senator Kyle is going to say, what evidence do you have that in fact doing this will advance our nonproliferation goals? And one hears this a lot from some folks in DOE and elsewhere, that you have no evidence that anything we do will affect nonproliferation. And so I think you then one's going to have to at least have a plausible answer that says, well, here's why we think we're going to get this thing you care about, which is progress on nonproliferation, if we do that. And my sense is clearly at kind of the moral political level, that's all true. But at the level of specificity, what concretely can you point to, that's underdeveloped because we just haven't had the discussions with other countries to know. Will it help on additional protocol? Will it help in some way that you can then specifically say, here's what we could get? And I think that's an exploration that needs to happen. But if that question weren't asked, I'd be thrilled. I just don't think it's not going to be asked.
By the way, there have been suggestions that there ought to be some hearings or something on the Hill that would discuss how the verification system has improved over the past 10 years since they last thought about it. Take a look at stockpile stewardship as well.
Avner Cohen, USIP. My question is primarily to George, but also to Ambassador Goodby. Ambassador Goodby refers to India and Pakistan in somewhat optimistic terms. I may slightly differ from you. I think that even in India, nuclear weapon at least semi-operational, if not fully operational. So my question is, to what extent there was a reception in terms of India and Pakistan to those proposals, and how much do you think they could be engaged in that kind of efforts? What's the reaction that you got about them?
One starts with India in this case, because what India does then affects at least politically Pakistan's calculation. You've seen recently in India a kind of an uptick of talk about nuclear disarmament as an objective. Now, I think part of that is because the government's trying to get the U.S.-Indian nuclear deal through, the resistance to it's from the left, and so there's a sense of kind of trying to raise the salience of disarmament as a way to make the left kind of more sympathetic. But that's always been an Indian position in any case, and so I think it would continue to be so. So in other words, if the leading kind of established nuclear weapons state said, we really want to pursue this objective and we want India to be part of the discussion, the Indians will come and be part of the discussion and subscribe to the objective, I strongly believe. Because, again, it's not unilateral disarmament, so the whole premise is China would have to be doing this as well, and so from an Indian point of view, fine. If China's going to get rid of its nuclear weapons, we can get rid of ours as long as Pakistan does too, et cetera. So the premise for such a discussion, an Indian leadership would say, yes, they can do it. In this Adelphi paper I'm writing on this general topic, taking nuclear disarmament seriously, which will be out in September, I was working on this last night. I do think that India would insist in the process on a permanent seat in the Security Council. And there is a strong basis for that. They insist on it now as it is. One of the major objections or reasons for saying they can't is they're not a member of the NPT, which is a key universal treaty, and how can you be the enforcer of an agreement that you don't subscribe to? But under the premise of moving towards nuclear disarmament, India would sign the NPT once disarmament's achieved, because that's then it's an equitable system. And so that objection, if everybody gets rid of nuclear weapons, including India, then the objection, a major objection of India's seat would disappear, and India would insist on it anyway. We're not going to give up the security that we get from nuclear weapons if China still has a veto over enforcing international peace and security, and we don't. So I just predict India would insist on this. Then Pakistan would say, me too. And the world would say, no, you don't meet any of the other criteria, which is objectively the case. But Pakistan would still then be able to make a legitimate argument, okay, fine, but whatever enforcement mechanism has to be there for this world without nuclear weapons, you know, you're disadvantaging us. We're not prepared necessarily to sign up to that if India's got a veto now, and we don't. So you'd have to work. That's very far down the road. Obviously, you'd have to deal with these bigger issues that I think would come up. But India kind of agreeing to begin the process, if the premise of U.S. and Russian leadership was there, I think absolutely they would.
John Caves of National Defense University. The thrust, as I read it, of the Shultz-Kissinger et al. Op-eds is that you need to articulate a bold vision of a nuclear weapons-free future in order to achieve a lot of things short of that that are important to make the world safer. Doing those things is much, I mean, there's a fundamental change when you do things to make the world safer, but it still has nuclear weapons, it has the basic power structure, and then actually look into a place where you wouldn't have nuclear weapons. It's a fundamental thing. And perhaps the focus on just getting to these important interim measures is why I haven't seen an argument addressed much, but I would hope somebody would hear. But if you get to a nuclear weapons-free world, what about the argument, what about the situation that what nuclear weapons have done is they prevented great power war. They prevented the kind of global war, a World War II, World War I. How do you deal with that? And that seems to be a fundamental thing. I haven't seen that addressed a lot in the arguments.
Well, you begin, I think, by recognizing that that is a serious problem that we really have to work through as we proceed. I would begin by saying also that nuclear deterrence, as we understood it during the Cold War, doesn't have much validity now, and that the relationship between the major powers is conditioned and affected by a lot of other things, not so much anymore by nuclear weapons. That brings me to the second point that I want to make about this whole program of reductions. I think as a technical matter, as a matter involving things like verification and so forth, the problems are relatively solvable. They're not easy, but you can bring to bear some pretty advanced technologies and skills and experience to see how you might actually do it. And so the real problems are not so much in that area as they are in the fact that as you reduce, the ramifications of all of this becomes more and more apparent, and you have to begin to solve a lot of other problems, not just the nuclear problem. And it's already evident, for example, when we speak about tactical nuclear weapons, for example, pretty clear that the Russian government will say, yes, but how about conventional forces in Europe? We need to solve that one, too. So that's up there. So you basically have to look not at a narrow agenda of nuclear weapons, but you have to look at a much broader one, including the one you mentioned, and that those problems will come up. I like to think that there's a benefit in terms of the relationships among the big powers by working together on these kinds of issues. And if that's true, then some of these problems that we're concerned about today probably will disappear.
I think it's a key question. I think the more salient problem, and I agree with Ambassador Goodby's response, and also clearly China's not going to go far in this direction if there's not a great deal of confidence that Taiwan's not going to declare independence and or that the U.S. would intervene militarily. And I mean, so there's these kind of immediate unresolved sovereignty issues have to get sorted out before you're going to get very far anyway. But so that's kind of as a given. But the more salient problem is actually different from the one you have. It is especially a Russian and Chinese, but also other countries, fear that in a world without nuclear weapons, the U.S. is going to be even more interventionary and will pursue more regime change and is be more of a threat, and so that nuclear weapons are the thing that keeps the U.S. out of their space. And so that's going to be a bigger problem for pursuing this objective than the idea of great power wars. Because most of them look at it, they say, who's going to start the great power war? In their view, it's going to be the United States. Whether it's through an intervention in Taiwan that escalates, or kind of the Middle East go around, which is one reason why I think people as traditionally realpolitik as Henry Kissinger actually advocate are being prepared to go to a world without nuclear weapons because it makes the U.S. more powerful. Well, other people aren't stupid, and so that's going to have to be part of this process. Will involve then reassuring other people about the exercise of U.S. power. And Russia will bring in issues of conventional arms control and space dominance. By the way, Russia will bring in other issues that they don't like to talk about, which their worry about China basically populating the Russian Far East, which Russia can't defend with conventional forces. So there are going to be lots of other issues that go to kind of the international kind of power realities that would come out of this process. And my own sense is all of that's to the good. Why should we be afraid of having those issues kind of come out and be addressed? It strikes me that what's wrong with that?
I agree on that last point, especially because I think I've always thought this is one of the spin-offs of this kind of a program. You really do have to solve a lot of regional security issues in order to make this work, and to bring those to the fore and try to work on them, I think is right.
Bob Barry from the British American Security Information Council. In talking to Jim Goodby earlier, I didn't mean to indicate that I thought that the door was open on this side of the Atlantic either. What the Russians were saying was that at Kennebunkport 2 years ago, they were really ready to engage in all this, but for the moment they see no prospect of doing so. I would draw attention to what George said, was that the only government so far that has spoken positively about all this is the British government. And thanks in part to Max Kampelman's trip there, and our organization has, I think, more impact in the UK than it does here. But anyhow, Des Brown's speech to the Conference on Disarmament was a really unusual thing for any defense minister to do. And the offer of the UK as a kind of laboratory for disarmament and to host discussions on verification systems, I thought was a very positive thing.
Please.
Okay. Diane Perlman, Abolition 2000 Global Council, and Working Group on Global Violence, Terrorism, and Nuclear Disarmament for Psychologists for Social Responsibility. Anyway, Max Kampelman, you just used the term defense mechanism, which is also a psychological term. And in addition to that nuclear weapons are a symptom, and then all the important things that you're saying, there are other dimensions that weigh against it. And in a way, nuclear weapons are like a scab that you have to deal with the underlying wound, which is healing the relationships, working more with reducing tension and replacing war with other strategies. And there's a lot of like false beliefs about, which George was mentioning, that we have to, have nuclear weapons to prevent this. Just that I think we need more second-order change, like with the Soviet Union, that we transformed our relationship so that the symptom didn't matter. So I think that's important to emphasize that more. And also that deterrence is not a proven theory. It breaks down. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it works best when it's accompanied by drastic tension reduction. And there's a belief that we have to have everything on the table and nuclear weapons on the table, and if we take them off, we'll be weak and vulnerable and more dangerous, whereas really tension reduction and security assurances are more effective. So just to, support the work that you're doing and include some other dimensions.
Daniel Serwer from USIP. I'm having a hard time picturing exactly why the United States would be better off without nuclear weapons. And I think part of that problem is defining what it means, what the end state really is. If the end state is that everybody is allowed to collect fissionable material, machine it into nuclear weapons, and just sit there with it in two separate rooms, that's one end state. It's quite a different end state if, as you suggested, George, that there's an agreement that that people wouldn't go past a certain point in enrichment, for example. So I want to ask, what really is the end state that you're envisaging here? What does having no nuclear weapons really mean?
Well, I think you have to answer your first question before you get on to that. And your first question is, why is the United States better off? I would answer it by saying that if trends continue as they now are, most people, I think, certainly the four that signed these articles, believe that there will be a nuclear explosion, very likely in an American city, with hundreds of thousands of people killed as a result. They'd like to reverse the present trends. As Sam Nunn has a nice image, he says, I can't quite see that mountaintop. I can't see the details of that you're asking about. But he said, I know that we're not headed towards that. I know we're headed in the opposite direction. We're in a downward spiral. And so therefore his basic urge, which all of them share, is that we should reverse that and try to move towards the mountaintop, even though one doesn't understand the details as well as one would like. But we haven't perhaps talked as much as we probably should have about some of these first steps. George did talk a bit about that, but the idea would be to use this image, a credible image, which I think we can do, to try to begin the steps that are necessary to make us safer, including some we've talked about. I agree with you, though, that we do need to have a lot more effort than has been seen so far about what is that end state, and various people are working on it. There's an interesting conference, which I did not attend, at Yale University on that very subject a couple of weeks ago, I think. So that's the best I can do for you on that particular question.
On the why it's in the U.S. interest, I mean, my shorthand would be go talk to kind of Russian strategic planners and they'll tell you why it's in the U.S. interest, which makes it complicated, but that's a shorthand. On the very important point of the end state, there will be degrees, and it's impossible to define now. In other words, there's some degrees above zero that look a lot like zero, so very low numbers, but then some people propose, well, you know, maybe you could have kind of an internationally authorized, very small deterrent force. There are lots of problems with that idea, but as you got close to that number, that's above zero, but it's something like that. I think we would pass through something like the Israeli posture. Not talked about in politics, not advertised, not brandished, not saber-rattled. It's kind of there. Well, that's inevitable on a stage as you're going to dismantle these things. Then you get to a point where probably the weapons are dismantled. They haven't been destroyed. They may not be destroyed. They're separated components. That's a degree above zero, but it's very different. And then at some point, you can imagine all the fissile material that came out of weapons is either being denatured for use in nuclear power plants, it's mixed oxide fuel, it's buried, what have you. That looks a lot like zero, but there's still these guys at laboratories, and that our Congress will insist that the laboratories keep people working just in case somebody cheats, and then others will insist on that. That's a degree below zero, but it's not... And we can just sit here and invent all these different degrees, but the point is, this is contingent. The governments involved would decide, and they might decide that 10 equals zero, new math. Ambassador Goodby negotiated all sorts of arms control treaties whose math are not the math any of us learned in school, right? I mean, one didn't equal one. It was, I mean, and so all of this would be contingent.
Hugh Gustafson, George Mason University. Thank you very much for the plug, George. I'm an anthropologist who studies the culture of nuclear weapons scientists. I was going to ask the Israel question, but let me ask a different question. I'm interested in the narratives that people live by and find compelling, and I want to know how a president would explain to the American people and make the American people find compelling a policy of abolishing our nuclear weapons. Because every president from Truman onwards has told us how deeply we need these weapons. They've told us we won't be safe without them. They've told us that you can't put the genie back in the bottle. They've told us during the Cold War that if the Russians got a slight edge, we would be in deep danger. If there was a policy of moving to nuclear abolition, there would be tremendous pushback from constituencies, from the weapons labs to all sorts of corporations and military constituencies. And many members of the American public would justifiably feel anxious about this. So what kind of narrative could an American president put out there that the American people would find really compelling for giving up what has been the bedrock of American security since
1960. Let me correct one thing first to you. That is to say, I would say, first of all, that presidents should make speeches like Ronald Reagan made, because Ronald Reagan did not make that argument that you made, especially in his last 2 years, when he was trying to get a discussion going on eliminating nuclear weapons. And he spoke to the public about that. And he said, in his view, nuclear weapons were good for nothing except annihilation. They had no purpose that was humane, and that, as far as he was concerned, the world would be much better off without them. And he said that repeatedly. He said it publicly. He said it to the other people more than once. And as a result of his efforts, there was what I would call, in somewhat academic terms, a paradigm shift. Up until that time, the basic idea had been arms control. That is to say, we want to make the deterrent more stable, and a lot of efforts went into that. It was successful. It was pretty stable. But at the same time, the numbers of nuclear weapons went up and up and up. Had he not changed that, we would have been ending up with at least 15,000 deployed nuclear warheads. But as he did change that, things began to change, to move downwards. And that year of 1986... saw a continuation of a decline to the point where we now have, or will have soon, only 1,700 or so deployed nuclear warheads. So presidents are capable of making changes in the way the dialogue goes. And I'm confident that a future president, armed with the same ideas as Ronald Reagan had, would be able to do this.
I think the trick would be a little, look, there's a reason why people are paying attention to what Secretary Schultz, Nunn, Perry, and Senator, and I forget who else, wrote, which is that precisely these guys have constructed national narratives, and they know how politics works and everything else. So I think the narrative would look a little bit like what they did, because they have this experience. I think the more difficult problem is not the narrative that you construct to tell the American people. It's how that narrative doesn't then give the others the argument not to go along with you. That's going to be the trick. Reagan did that in a way, because he didn't kind of try to say, oh, and by the way, we'll get all this other stuff from these people as a payoff. It was, and I think that then has a better chance of resonating globally. But the narrative most likely to be constructed for domestic political reasons, you know, here are the 10 reasons why it's in our advantage. Don't tell anybody. It's kind of a ruse, but we win. And then the others hear, and it doesn't work. That's going to be the hard part.
In the few ticks of the clock left, we'll go back. Jim, do you have any final thoughts, words?
I just would quote what George Shultz said in his opening speech in Oslo. Wake up, everybody. But I see you are awake already, so thanks very much for coming.
George?
No, thanks.
Max?
I have some comments.
Please.
I want to say that the reason I did not really respond much or initiate anything during this interesting and important discussion is that I have reluctantly concluded that this won't work, that what's being discussed won't work, that the efforts that we have been making for so many long period of time are so complicated, so difficult to enforce, that I reluctantly concluded that was not the area in which I wanted to begin concentrating. Where I have come up is a variation, which maybe I'll share. It's not complicated, but it's there. In my opinion, this business of trying to get treaties ratified, which we're trying to do now, and trying to get other countries to join us in going down, when we also know that it's spreading, the poison is spreading constantly. You know, what we're doing is we're going to countries, well, you're a professor and you're a teacher, you got students, and you tell them not to smoke, that it's bad for them, that they'll get cancer. And as he's speaking, he's got a cigarette dangling out of his lips. And that's where I find ourselves as I analyze the world today. And my own judgment is that a different approach is required. Maybe more dramatic. I don't think more difficult, because what impresses me even with this discussion is the immense difficulty in the number of barriers that stand in the way that are discouraging. Correct, I have no doubt that the people urging these are correct, but I don't see it happening. And what I'm looking for, and where I have at least for the moment landed, is the requirement that I would like to see the United States, with or without Russia, preferably with, but maybe without, introduce a resolution at the United Nations General Assembly declaring that the possession of these weapons of mass destruction is a gross violation of the laws upon which the United Nations are created, the motivation of the United Nations, and that zero should be the goal and the stated law of the General Assembly, down to zero, and that countries found in violation, or forces found in violation of that zero, should be politically, economically, and culturally isolated in the world. Now, that would be the ought. I talked about the ought earlier. The General Assembly has the power to declare an ought, and we ought to be leading the world. We ought to be speaking to the peoples of the world and saying, this is what our country wants, and that's why we're putting in this resolution, because the world ought to go to zero. Now, then the Security Council ought to be assigned the task of coming up with the inspection procedures which prevent cheating. Obviously, no country will want to give up a single weapon if it isn't certain that its neighbor also is giving up the weapon. Now, what I'm giving you is obviously complicated, takes time, but I myself, speaking for myself, do not believe that what we've come up until now will work. And I go on further to say that I cannot assure the world that if I were advising the President of the United States, I'd be speaking not only to the United Nations General Assembly, but I'd be speaking to the people of the world, which will help us politically anyhow, and we need that. We ought to be associated with zero in the world, and the best way to do that is to do that in the forum of the world. And difficult to achieve, yes. Difficult to begin, no. And an integral part of this, in my opinion, ought to be a clear, maybe the United Nations should create a bank to buy up all the weapons-grade material that exists and turn it into energy material in an energy-starved world. Well, I didn't mean to get into that, but I did want to explain why I was not actively engaged in the questions and answers, because I really do not feel a bit encouraged about that approach. And it just seems so complicated to me that I just don't see it. And I'm looking for something that I think is a great deal more practical. And even the advancing of it, whether it happens or not, would be helpful to the world.
thank you all. I suspect this will not be the last session we'll have on this issue or its variations, but we appreciate your coming and thank our presenters.
I thought you'd forgotten that one, actually.